from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, we'll be joined in the next hour by Rice University professor and author Jeff Kripal, who is the author of Authors of the Impossible, the Paranormal and the Sacred. We'll find out why he believes the study of the paranormal has been debased by popular culture and why he considers paranormal phenomena both what he calls a trickster and the return of the repressed. Plus, we'll find out all about the four mystics he chooses to profile in his new book and why he finds our superheroes have super, perhaps supernatural, meaning to communicate to us. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our Forum program. Jeffrey Kripal is professor of philosophy and religious thought and a historian of religion at Rice University, author of books on Esalen Institute and Gnosticism and Ramakrishna's mysticism. His new book is called Authors of the Impossible, and it highlights four mystical thinkers and takes us into the realm of the paranormal and the sacred. He joins us in studio for this second hour of the Forum program. And Jeff, good to have you back here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me again, Michael.
Well, where to begin with this? Let's begin, actually, with an article that appeared by someone we both know, Mark Oppenheimer, in the New York Times, where he called you a renegade. And he called you a renegade because you want to include the paranormal in religious studies. And, you know, skeptics recoil at that. And lots of folks probably think that's inappropriate, especially religious folks. But by your standards and your vision, it's quite appropriate.
It is indeed. I think it's, you know, the paranormal, of course, is a very modern way of talking about experiences that previous cultures and traditions would have framed in religious or magical terms. So I think it's just, it's another way of talking about religious experience.
In fact, even in the academy, this used to be sort of, integral to the study of academic pursuits and academic subjects. And your thesis is that things took a different turn when popular culture got in the way.
Well, actually, no. My thesis is that the categories of the paranormal and the psychical arose in elite intellectual centers in the 19th century, mostly Cambridge in England and then Harvard in the States. And then as Western philosophy and Western psychology took kind of behaviorist and materialist turns in the 20s and 30s, it went out of favor. And it's been repressed ever since, and it appears in popular culture now because that's the only place we allow it to appear.
Yeah, you don't think of it as being repressed somehow when you see the tabloids and you see all the, you know, Oprah and all those kinds of people who are drawn to the paranormal or psychic phenomena.
Well, you don't realize it's repressed until you try to talk about it in elite contexts or with people who have authority in the culture who are not always open to these sorts of discussions, but often are, I should add, as well.
Well, you know, Duke University, of course, comes immediately to my mind because they did so many studies of clairvoyance and things of that sort. But there is a kind of intellectual it's looked on maybe as being the way some intellectuals look at religion.
It depends on the intellectuals you're talking to. My sense of this, I've lectured a lot on this book. I've spoken at a lot of universities, and my profound sense is that a lot of folks are frankly in the closet on this one. They know what happens. They've had these experiences themselves. Particularly anthropologists, by the way. Anthropologists and physicists are, believe it or not, are the two groups that I find most receptive to this. And I think it's particularly for the anthropologists is that really, really weird things have happened to them in the field, and they know it happens. They don't always have a framework for it, but they know that it's not just an issue of fraud or misperception or something along those lines.
You're talking about things like extraordinary coincidences or having a prescient feeling about something and then it comes into fruition. I mean, all those kinds of things. Stuff we really just don't know about.
Right.
That's why I wrote my last book, but a part of the reason why I did. But you know, a lot of comes under the whole framework that you're talking about here, the paranormal. We think of telekinesis. We think of UFOs. I mean, there's so much. I remember the Bay Area skeptics put up a reward. They had their own standards of what would be permissible in terms of proving incontrovertibly some of these phenomena. Anybody who could prove the whole list that you could go through here would get this, I think it was $10,000. Nobody got the reward.
Right, and there's a reason, of course, for that. If you get to declare the rules, then you, of course, can pretty much guarantee you're going to win the game. And one of the things that I point out in the book is that, you know, in some sense, the skeptics are right here. These events do not play by the rules of science. They're not objects out there that we can manipulate and measure and replicate. And so when you apply the scientific method to them, of course, they disappear.
In fact, you say science shouldn't be the way to prove or disprove. Too much scientism, too much left brain. What do we use instead then in lieu of all that?
Well, that's a really good question.
That is the question, maybe. Isn't it?
The methods I use in the book are literature, actually. And anthropology and ethnography and the history of religions. And by that I simply mean that if you listen to people very carefully when they talk about these experiences, they often say, you know, it was like I was caught inside a story or a novel, or I was inside a movie, and I knew it was happening, but I didn't have any control over it. And that's sort of this uncanny feeling that they get. And so my approach to the paranormal is to see them essentially as events that are stories that have come alive and that we're somehow authoring. Levels of us, though, we're not aware of. And I guess that's my—
We're providing the narrative.
We're providing the narrative, and there's something about consciousness here that we don't understand. I mean, for me, a paranormal event is something that is simultaneously happening in the external world. It involves physical matter, but it also involves the psyche or human consciousness. And if you remove either of those poles, it goes away. And that's why the scientific method doesn't work here, is that it doesn't recognize consciousness. And so it can't study these things. And so, and this is the sense I say to the skeptics, you're absolutely right. This isn't a proper object of science. Although there are some really good scientists who study this, and they get results, but they're very small statistical results. The really robust stuff always happens spontaneously. It always happens in the real world, not in a lab, and it usually happens around trauma or death. And this, again, is why you can't put it into a lab.
Yeah, I remember when Jacob Needleman, whom you probably know, philosopher, local, wrote a book on God. He said there's external empiricism and there's internal empiricism. And the skeptical frame of mind or turn of mind would be very distrusting toward the internal empiricism. And so there's all that emphasis again on the external empiricism, but it's too hard to prove so many of these things or to disprove so many of these things. So that's why people like Jeff Kripal come along and say, I believe nothing and I believe everything.
That's right.
And in fact, let's talk about your own experience here because it's relevant. One time I know you wanted to be a Benedictine monk. Now you're a professor at Rice and a religious historian. But you had an experience in India that's probably worth recounting in terms of your own narrative here.
Right, I did. Well, you know, first of all, back up a little. Most of my experiences in this realm are more humble. And I think every writer has them. It's what we call the library angel. It's when you're working on an idea or a paragraph or something, and a book sometimes literally falls off the shelf or just appears in weird ways. And so there's this synchronicity in the creative process that I think all writers and all real creative people experience.
Can I just give you a quick example? Because I wrote about this. I was reading a novel of Philip Roth's called Indignation. I was about to interview him the next day, and I had been writing something, and I was writing actually about Bertrand Russell and the famous speech he gave on why I'm not a Christian. And I just put it down for a minute, and then I picked up the Roth book again, you know, sort of multitasking. And there in Roth's book was not only reference to it, but quoting from the same essay. And you wonder, what does this mean?
Right.
One doesn't know what it means, I guess, ultimately.
Well, I think though writers and creative people take those as essentially as signs to follow. You don't have to make a big deal out of them, but you follow them. And so those are the humble ones.
Let's get back to you in India, 1989 though, right?
1989, I was there. I was living in Calcutta. I was really just beginning to research my book on Ramakrishna and his own mystical experiences. And it was during Kali Puja, which is this extraordinary festival season in Calcutta. And the night after the puja, I woke up asleep. In other words, consciousness came online, but my body was essentially paralyzed or frozen. And this actually is a physiological state we know about. It's called sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. It's well studied. But then something quite extraordinary happened. Some kind of bizarre plasmic electromagnetic energy sort of took me over and created extreme states of arousal and fear. I suspected I was dying. And then I felt myself leaving the body. I could feel this kind of classic out-of-body experience. And then it became humorous because I didn't, of course, want to leave my body.
Called it the birth above the body.
Yeah. Right. Well, this is what was happening. But it was an extremely energetic state. It wasn't a dream. It was very much about energy. And as I was leaving my body, I grabbed the bedpost and I pulled myself back down and back into my body, and then woke up, and then I could control the body again. But those energies stayed with me, and they're still in me in some sense. And that really was by far the most extreme experience along these lines that I've ever had. It's useful to me to this day because when I read people who have out-of-body experiences or I read people who are zapped by a UFO or something, I say, I understand.
Many people say, what substance was he on? Or woo-woo or, you know.
I wasn't on anything.
Your consciousness. It's what you're saying is consciousness.
I was immersed in a set of religious rituals that were very meaningful to me. I was immersed in a set of texts that were meaningful to me. So it did not come out of the blue. It obviously was connected to the kind of tantric culture that I was immersed in. But it certainly wasn't induced by any drug or anything I had ingested because I hadn't.
Let's talk about, you're writing a book now about four mystics. What do they have in common? What brought you to this quartet of mystics? The only one of whom I was familiar with was Jacques Vallée, who lived out here for a while, who interviewed Jacques, a number of times.
Yeah, Jacques still lives in the Bay Area. This book came out of my Esalen project. I wrote a history of the human potential movement in 2007, during which I encountered lots of folks and lots of stories that I had no way of processing with all of my decades of reading and writing in the field. And so I decided that this was something that was worth, pursuing. I chose these four authors for two reasons. One is they span the whole history from the 1870s all the way to today. So I wanted a historical sweep. But also I chose them because, frankly, they're all extraordinary writers. I was drawn to their writing and to their a very specific way they think about these things, which is what I call both and.
We should mention quickly, we're talking here in addition to Jacques Vallée about Frederick Myers, who actually gave us the word telepathy.
He did, 1882.
And with, who's the Frenchman, Bertrand Meyers?
The second one is Charles Fort,
right.
This wonderful American writer who died in 1932. The third is Jacques Vallée, and the fourth is a contemporary a philosopher and sociologist in France named Bertrand Meyers. And so they span this whole thing. But also all four of these men think about the paranormal in terms of the both and instead of the either or. And I think this is the real message of the book, that once you approach a paranormal event or a psychical experience with an up or down vote, the game's over. You're not going to get very far.
But when you talk about stories and consciousness, you're also talking, it seems to me, with these four and in your own experiences about texts or narratives or stories which become symbiotic with our need for maybe something paranormal. In other words, and I know you're working now on superheroes, and that has some resonance here as well. It's like what we create out of our imagination is maybe coincidentally or not so coincidentally connected to what is called the paranormal.
Absolutely. I'm completely convinced of that. And all four of these men saw the imagination as linked to the mind's ability to relate to the external world in these extraordinary ways.
Mark Twain used to say, sit down, type a letter to someone, and don't mail it, and you'll hear back from them, that kind of thing.
Do you know that Twain actually was completely obsessed with this stuff?
I do know that. In fact,
this is the mental
telegraphy. The new autobiography that's just been released by UC Press. Let me open the phone lines now, because this is a rich topic we're talking about with Jeffrey Kripal. His new book is called Authors of the Impossible, and I know many of you have paranormal stories. If you do, keep them short, please. But also just the whole question of how you respond to this whole realm. I mean, are you skeptical? Are you open? Are you a believer? In general, I'd like to hear what your thoughts are, and our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can call us now. It's 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your calls. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment. Talk about the paranormal as a trickster through and through. What do you mean by that, Jeff?
Well, if you look at these experiences carefully, you can often detect a kind of trickster quality, by which I mean two things. One is they're often very playful, and they're often funny and humorous. There's a kind of – the world has a sense of humor in these things. But also, I think sometimes the truth is spoken through the trick. And the example I like to give here is the placebo. You know, we know a lot about the placebo. You can give sugar pills to people, and about 30% of the time, it'll fix whatever they need fixed. So that's a trick. That's a pure moment of fraud on the part of the experimenter, but it works.
Well, in the same way, there are people who feel they are healed and they can be in a wheelchair for years and suddenly they're up and they're, you know, skipping rope and all that sort of thing. I mean, yeah. Is this paranormal or is this just somehow a different form of consciousness, psychosomatic versus real, whatever?
Yeah, I wouldn't call that paranormal. I think to be paranormal in this technical sense, it needs to be something in the external environment corresponding to something going on in the psyche. But I think the psychosomatic stuff is a way toward that sort of thing. And I think people are healed. And I think we don't understand that. So I think a lot of times, you know, 19th century with all these seances and mediums, a lot of this was theater. And there was a lot of trick involved. There was fraud involved.
And Houdini exposed a lot of it and said, if I can reach you once I'm gone, I will. And we haven't heard from him yet, have we?
Well, I don't know. I haven't. but you know, real things happened during those theatrical tricks.
Such as?
Well, people had experiences of their dead loved ones. I mean, people received
messages.
But you say
they were
messages.
Real. How do we know the messages can be authenticated? Again, you're in that whole realm.
Again, we don't. But we know they experienced things, and we know that they weren't always lying and that they weren't always misperceiving. These were real experiences.
So I know someone who went to a seance, in fact, who I wrote about, who was absolutely disconsolate with respect to her father's death. And then she heard things from the medium that she felt the medium couldn't possibly have known.
Right. This is a common experience.
And couldn't have gotten off the internet or any kind of research or whatever. And, of course, skeptical frame of mind says, well, got it somehow, or maybe it was just a lucky hit and you didn't remember the misses. You know, that's a typical
right.
kind of skeptic response.
Right.
But this person was led away from grieving as a result of this.
That's right. It was healing.
Yeah, it was healing. I mean, what do you know, you got to give props to that, don't you?
Right. Well, you know, this is the origin of the term telepathy, actually. The origin is this was originally a skeptical term, believe it or not, because the hypothesis was that when loved ones go to mediums and the mediums nail all these details, they're not accessing the dead loved one. They're reading the mind of the person sitting in front of them. And so in this kind of humorous way, telepathy was designed to be suspicious of the spirit
hypothesis.
The powers
of the medium, yeah.
But to do it, you had to invoke this other power that was also, in some sense, unbelievable. And so you get in these little loops here.
Well, where does the sacred come into this?
Well, the sacred is a technical term that scholars of religion use. And by it, we mean an energy or a presence in the environment that is experienced as both terrifying and positive, often at the same time. So there's this both-and quality to the sacred. And the reason this is so helpful with the paranormal is, of course, not all paranormal experiences are positive. Some are terrifying. People get really, really traumatized by these things. And if you're operating with a very simple notion, you know, of demons and angels, then you dismiss one and you accept the other. But if you approach it through the category of the sacred, you can see both the positive and the negative of two sides of the same coin.
Which also is the objective and the subjective, as you point out. And you say yet the deepest question for us all maybe is, who are we?
That's my deepest question.
That's ontological. That's from whence we came, where we're going, all those sorts of things.
By that I mean, look, I study – what I've spent my life studying is extreme religious experiences. And by that I don't mean having a pious feeling in church or during a ritual.
You mean William James.
I mean William James. I mean leaving your body. I mean getting zapped by something. I mean being completely transformed through a single and singular experience. And what these experiences suggest to me is that we're not simply egos. We're not simply Michaels or Jeffs walking around. That there's something in us, deep in us, that is much more expansive, much more powerful, and much more interesting, frankly, than our social selves with all of their cultural and religious beliefs and all their limitations.
Thinking about the fact that just earlier this week, Tavis Smiley, who's a well-known public television personality and interviewer and also has a radio program, we were talking just about the difference between the heart and the head, and it's sort of not even tangential, quite relevant to what we're talking about, it seems to me, because it's as if the heart wants certain things, often that have to do with the mystical, and the head, rationality and cerebrality particularly, will not necessarily look at those in the same way that the heart hungers for those.
Right. And the way I address that in the book, I don't talk about the heart and the head. I talk about the two heads. You know, there's two brains in there. There's two hemispheres, and they process information very, very differently.
So you're really talking right brain, left brain.
Right brain, left brain. Yeah. And you know, we know a lot about those things, and we know the ego is essentially a piece of software running on the left hemisphere. And things that come through the right hemisphere, it doesn't understand and it doesn't always like, but they come through anyway. And that's really all I'm trying to say here is that we're two, we're not one.
They're doing a documentary film on all this, huh?
I am. I'm working with a close friend of mine named Scott Jones, and we're working on a documentary on authors of the impossible.
And where do the superheroes come in? Because that's sort of where you're moving next, I think, isn't it?
It is. The book's coming out in October. It's called Mutants and Mystics, and it's on the paranormal in the history of science fiction and superhero comics. And the thesis there basically is that if you look or if you talk to artists and authors who produced this material, you often find that they've had these exact kinds of extreme paranormal experiences. And instead of proving them or disproving them, they turn them into popular culture.
Of course, I remember reading a paper that said that all of these notions of little green men, I mean, or the picture that people had of what aliens and extraterrestrials look like came about really with the sci-fi movies in the 50s that
right.
were the catalyst for all that.
That's partly
and
correct.
People didn't feel much alien abduction or talk about alien abduction before those films.
Well, that's actually, it's true and it's not true. People have been abducted by beings from the sky for millennia. That is the history of religion.
Oh, there's myth. Yeah, you're right.
Right.
And that we call it, again, the myth, the religion, the paranormal.
Right.
Oh, boy. Fascinating stuff. We're going to continue, in fact, with Jeff Kripal. Again, his book is Authors of the Impossible. And we're going to take your calls and find out what you have to say about this whole realm that we're talking about here. And it is a realm. It's a world unto its own. But maybe, as Jeff's saying, it's a world that many of us know all too well and too intimately. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jeffrey Kripal, who goes where many academics will not go, exploring the mysteries of telepathy, teleportation, and other paranormal phenomena. He's a religious studies professor at Rice University and sorts through fact and fiction in his recent book, Authors of the Impossible. He's here with us in studio. We're going to go forthwith to your calls and your emails and postings on the web and the like. First, let's talk about mutants and all that, mystics, because this is really part of the experience that many people are more familiar with in some ways, where the paranormal is concerned and where your next book is going to be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this was the book I thought I was writing when I wrote Authors of the Impossible. I set out to write a book on the paranormal in science fiction and superhero comics, and and decided I really couldn't do that until I knew what I was talking about. So I wrote this one first. But this book coming out in October is very much about the resonance between the mythologies that have developed largely on the East Coast in New York, where the comic book industry is, and the mystical movements that have been generated in California here, actually in the Bay here. So it really comes out of my Esalen history again, and my conclusion that the human potential movement, with its emphasis on evolution producing these sorts of supernormal powers, is the flip side of the X-Men and the superhero mythologies on the East Coast. So I'm looking at that resonance between mythology and mysticism.
Yeah, you mentioned Esalen, and both Mike Murphy and the late George Leonard are good friends of mine. And you write about George's book, Education in Ecstasy, and a moment when he thought he was really right in the presence of a witch.
Right.
And I'd never heard that story as well as I knew George. And it was kind of fascinating because there was something about that story that that really grabbed me as a reader.
Yeah.
Part of it has to do, of course, with being a friend of his, but that sense that he was in some kind of mythic moment,
right,
which people have.
Right.
And don't necessarily understand, but they feel, and they feel in such a deep and profound way.
Well, you know, George was writing about education in that book, and he was writing about what education could be if we took these human potentials and developed them instead of repressing them. And what's so extraordinary about that, and where it links in with the X-Men mythology, is that a lot of paranormal phenomena, believe it or not, hovers around puberty. There's something about puberty that generates, for example, poltergeist phenomena. And so there's something about youth and puberty and sexual maturation that's all linked to this stuff too. And that's really what George was writing about in that paragraph. He sensed a young witch, a kind of erotic witch in this classroom that he entered. And it scared him. And
this is a man who was a tough bomber pilot and all
right,
that kind of stuff. But it gets into that whole notion that you write about as the return of the repressed,
right,
which is a Freudian term, but or notion, but somehow that, well, what one goes through in childhood keeps coming back in different ways. In fact, Nietzsche said it's all eternal return. That's all that our lives are made of,
right,
some way or another. Let's bring in our callers, though, and let's find out what they have to say. And we begin, Gregory, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to relate my experience as an artist, as a painter, having, quasi-religious experiences in my art-making process. I'm an abstract artist, and I have a lot of kinship with painters like the Cubists and Wesley Kandinsky. And actually, I don't know if you guys know the story of how Kandinsky sort of happened upon abstract art, but it's when he lived in a boat, and he came home one night partially from drinking, and one of his paintings was upside down in the boat, and it was dimly lit, and he realized it was his work, but it wasn't his work. And at that moment, he had sort of this revelation that here's pure abstraction right here, and he took it from there. And I think that's a real interesting story where a combination of things come together and create sort of a movement of the 20th century that everybody else just could find and seek into. And of course, Picasso and Leger took it and went with Cubism.
Yeah, it's a good story. And Gregory, thank you for it. That whole notion of how artists work. And I mean, Blake felt you were in touch as an artist with powers that, were paranormal, I guess.
Yeah, and Gregory, a surrealism, of course, is the other artistic movement here that taps into this very deeply.
Unconscious more, again. Yeah.
But they were, very much into the weird and the strange. And actually, again, in the book coming out in the fall, I expand it from authors of the impossible to artists of the impossible and look at how art actually can become a kind of medium or a channel of this as well.
Well, there's always the notion that maybe a dream will lead to an artist's create. In fact, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde right out of a dream.
Well, Frederick Myers writes about this first author of The Impossible. It was very much connected to the phenomenon of genius for him. And, of course, genius being not doing really well on your SAT test, but having ideas that you didn't think, this sort of notion of intellectual inspiration.
And we'll bring more callers on. And it sounds like Dean is a skeptic about all this. Hi, Dean. You're on.
Hi, thank you, Michael. Yeah, I'm a scientist and a college professor in the East Bay, and many of the arguments that your guests has made in the beginning of the interview about science not being applicable to testing the paranormal are pretty typical arguments you hear in that realm when scientific testing doesn't find evidence for the paranormal phenomenon being claimed as being existing, or being able to do some enormous power or extraordinary power. We call that the delicate flower hypothesis in science. As soon as you study it scientifically, the amazing power that the person claimed to have had disappears. And the more amazing statistic, rather than the Bay Area skeptics, is James Randi has a $1 million prize that no one's been able to claim. And the rules that are set are basic rules of scientific demonstration of some phenomenon occurring.
Now, Randi got sued. Randi got sued by Uri Geller. I mean, that's a whole saga in its own right. But there are scientific standards. No, you're absolutely right.
It doesn't mean anything about. Doesn't have anything to do with the validity of the claims that Randi made.
No, I understand.
And then eventually, that suit was eventually thrown out of court.
Right. You want to respond here, Jeffrey?
Yeah, Kirkland? I mean, Dean, I'm not sure I'm disagreeing with you. I mean, my point is that the scientific method, at least as I understand it, has very rigorous parameters. And once you apply those parameters, the phenomenon essentially disappears because it doesn't play by those rules. So I'm not here to debunk science. I'm here to simply say people have these experiences, and simply because you can't prove them or in a laboratory or with scientific method doesn't mean they don't happen. It just means that they lie outside the methods of science. The other thing I would say is, I do know scientists who study these things, and they would argue very vociferously that there is good evidence, and that what happens in the scientific community is the goalposts just keep getting moved further and further down the field. So I can't speak to that. Those aren't my disciplines. But I do think that whatever's going on here lies largely outside the realm of traditional science.
Well, thank you, Dean, for the call. A number of years ago, Phil Clayton, a local philosopher, invited me to go to Harvard and be an interviewer of a conference called Science and the Spiritual Quest. And he had some really extraordinary international.
I know Phil well.
Yeah, I figured you might. And Sir John Templeton put up the money for this. And there were scientists there. It goes back to what you said before. They were absolutely first-rate scientists, internationally famed scientists. Right. And they had this little corner that they sort of proved in some ways or struck them as giving some verification. But when you're using the real rule, and in fact, it reminds me, we were talking about Esalen, Mike Murphy and John Cleese and others have worked on this whole idea of maybe there's something posthumous going on. There's something beyond.
Right, postmortem survival.
Yeah, and they have all these little kinds of things that kind of make you wince and provoke you and everything, but the hard proof or what we consider the hard proof is just not there.
Yeah. Well, again, people would disagree. In terms of hard proof, no. But people would say that there's a kind of building consensus, particularly in the ethnographic data. But again, that's not traditional science. That's more akin to sociology or anthropology.
Here's a listener who says, as an anthropologist and cognitive psychologist, mysteries of the supernatural are less interesting than the cognition involved in producing these beliefs. We know now that it is easier to have some beliefs than others. Beliefs that take intuitive everyday concepts like human beings walk around and talk and tweak it in a small way, like ghosts are human beings that walk around and talk and experience time but are immaterial, are much easier for the human mind to accept than beliefs that violate intuition egregiously. Another listener writes, I wonder if the author ever read Swami Vivekananda's books, Jnana Yoga and Raja Yoga. He was one of the most prominent Indian thinkers or philosophers of the 20th century, but somehow missed the limelight. Do you know his work?
Yeah, I do.
I figured you did. Yeah, okay. Another listener writes, the Westerners don't like to recognize this so much. However, if you go to Asian countries, they're highly believed and respected. Most Filipinos have at least one story to tell you about an encounter with the paranormal. Dennis writes, I was wondering if Dr. Kripal is familiar with the Berkeley Psychic Institute. I've taken several classes there, found it to be interesting, fun, and believe it or not, useful and practical. It's true that it's not always an intellectual pursuit, but a lot of worthwhile activities fall into the category: running, bicycling, yoga, music, movies, prayer. I'm sure you can add to the list.
I'm not aware of it. Sorry.
Well, but when he talks about these activities, you know, people, they get into this kind of what they call the zone.
Right.
And it almost is mystical, really, in many instances.
I think any activity that temporarily suppresses ego function is a potential trigger of these things. So sports can do it. Skydiving can do it. Psychedelics can do it. Sexual experience can do it. Car wrecks can do it. Heart surgeries can do it. You have
it's like
to
the kind of things to say, it made a believer out of me, right?
Right. You have to suppress the ego function, though.
Here's Dave, who says, when I was at the end of my eighth grade school year, a long-term guest of a neighbor predicted someone important was going to be assassinated. My buddy and I said something mundane and then moved on to other things. But then later that evening, we turned white as ghosts. When we entered my friend's house and saw a crowd of visitors crowded around the TV set as Robert Kennedy had just been shot. I don't really know how to place this experience in my world. Do you have advice?
Well, precognition is one of the most commonly reported paranormal experiences. And there are different models for it. The truth is we don't understand it. But it clearly violates what we think of as linear time, you know. And this is where the physicists come in and point out that what we think of as time doesn't apply on other levels of even the physical world. So there are ways to model this, but we simply don't understand it.
Our guest again is Jeffrey Kripal. His book is Authors of the Impossible. And John writes, it's not about science in a cold clinical vein. It's about logic. And your guest purveys fallacious thinking. Confirmation bias, for instance, a book falls from his shelf which relates to a topic on his mind. Does he pay equal attention to the dozens of times when a book unrelated to his thinking falls to the floor? And he finds it fantastic that two people happen to run into each other in an unexpected setting. 1 in 1,000 coincidences do happen 1 in 1,000 times. There's nothing fantastic in this at all.
There is something fantastic to the people to whom these things happen. And of course, some things are simply coincidence. We know that. I'm not denying that. But sometimes the level of coincidence is so over the top, is so extraordinary, that the person just stands back and says, this is different. This is different. And again, that I think we have to honor. We have to honor the subjective experience of these events, just as we have to analyze them with all of our rational capacities as well. We have to honor both sides of the equation there.
And there are people who will say to you, do I have to honor what I think is cuckoo?
No, of course you don't have to until something cuckoo happens to you. And then perhaps you do have to honor it.
Let's honor some more of our callers by bringing them in here. And Richard, you're next up. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have read Professor Kripal's book, and I found it one of the most interesting, provocative, and troubling books I've ever read. So I'm delighted to have a chance to ask a question. I want to ask about Jacques Vallée, who I know a little bit and lives in the Bay Area, and particularly has what I found fascinating ideas about UFOs. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Jacques, who is also the model for the character in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, played by
François Truffaut, yeah.
So if you maybe I think that it would bring the book home if he could tell a few of the specific stories about Jacques and his view of UFOs.
Of course, what's fascinating about Jacques is he's an astronomer and then became a computer scientist. So he's got some real, shall we say, bona fides there.
I can give a brief version of Jacques' life. I mean, as Michael just said, he started out as an astronomer and then helped map Mars, actually, at UT in the early 60s, and then did a computer science degree at Northwestern, where he met a man named J. Allen Hynek, who was running Project Blue Book. Jacques' original hypothesis was the extraterrestrial spaceship hypothesis that was very common in the 50s and 60s, even among the military. But he was also a very learned and literary man, and he began reading a lot of folklore, a lot of particularly medieval folklore. And he realized that a lot of these UFO encounters, which he had researched with Hynek, resembled old folklore accounts of encountering elves and demons and angels and things. And so he began to become more skeptical of the, you know, walk up and kick the landing gear approach. And he realized that UFOs behave more like religious experiences than material events. And that book came out. It's called Passport to Magonia in 1969. He then even made it more radical in 1975 with a follow-up called The Invisible College, in which he observed something that a lot of people who study these things observe, that people who have been zapped or abducted or terrified by these things often develop paranormal powers. They become telepathic, or they have spiritual awakenings, or their lives are changed in some dramatic and positive way. And so, the further Jacques got into the actual material, and by that I mean he went out and interviewed people. He studied these things, both with the tools of science and the tools of anthropology and the history of religion. He got further and further into what I'm calling this both-and approach. That yes, some UFOs leave physical traces. They show up on radar. They leave traces on the ground. People have radiation sickness, have eye burns. I mean, physical symptoms, and yet they're never quite fully physical. We have no UFO. We have no hard evidence.
No souvenirs.
And so for Jacques, it's very much this both and that I'm trying to get at in the book and. So I appreciate that. I hope it was more provocative than disturbing to you.
And we thank you, Richard, for your call. Also reminds me of John Mack, whom I wrote about, who used to be head of the psychiatry department at Harvard, and really was under the – well, he had people who he hypnotized who seemed to have been abducted. And he began to believe in those abductions because they had been through trauma, and under hypnosis trauma appeared. And, of course, he was vilified and ridiculed, made fun of.
He was almost fired.
He almost lost his job. He was a tenured professor. But – it reminded me of some of those false allegations, many of them false allegations that were made about molestation and proved to have no substance to them, because in the people's minds, they were clearly real.
Right.
I mean, there were people who were flailing around like they had gone through, you know, an extraordinary kind of torture, some kind of horror, which made Mac into a believer. But it makes you wonder, what is the mind capable of creating?
Right. And I think this is where we have to be very, very careful. And this is why I say that I believe everything and I don't believe anything. In other words, I believe that these people had these experiences. I think we need to take them much more seriously than we do. I think they point to some type of reality, perhaps in us. But I don't believe the literal frame of the narratives. I think the mind is always translating, always projecting, always filtering these experiences through its culture, through its belief system, and through the ego.
And here again, a listener, Kevin, writes, "Count me as a skeptic. When there's activity that we cannot explain, we say God did it. We make a mistake believing that the inability to disprove paranormal or supernatural activity means that supernatural explanations are equally as likely as natural explanations. If I told you that there's a teacup orbiting Venus, you could not disprove it. This does not mean that it is just as likely to be true as it is to be false."
It's a tough crowd this morning, Michael.
Well, they're skeptics.
That's fine.
So am I. But I'm open, and I think lots of people are. Here's Joey, who writes, "As someone who has experienced the paranormal realm throughout my lifetime, I've come to see it as an extension or expansion of what we call normal world experience, a sort of subatomic realm that I could never prove to anyone. But then again, I have no need to prove it." It's interesting because the great Nobel laureate Isaac Bashevis Singer said that nobody knew there was bacteria, but, you know, there is bacteria, right?
Right.
You have to find the ways to measure it or to verify it. He goes on, Joey, to write, "I can only talk about these experiences with those who have a context to understand them. I think a quote from Richard Bach's Illusion speaks well on why some do and some don't have paranormal experience. Quote, argue for your limitations and sure enough, they're yours. We only see what we want or believe we'll see cuts both ways." Joan writes, "Thanks for explaining something that always baffled me. A 60-year-old atheist married to a scientist now. When I was 18, freshly a new non-virgin, reading Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki deeply, I lay in a hot bath and moved a skipping phonograph needle. It wasn't a coincidence because I felt myself do it. Never could do it again." And Elizabeth says, "Good timing for this topic. Just started a conversation on Facebook about synesthesia," which, by the way, we did a program on many, many years ago. Synesthesia, yeah. She writes, "is a neurological condition experienced by 10 to 15% of the population. For us synesthetics, colors, sounds, tastes, and so occur involuntarily in what might seem to others to be inappropriate places. We experience the world very differently from most people, and this fact is a result of what's going on in our brains." Actually, many synesthesics are, of course, artists, And,
that's right.
You know, it's extraordinary how many of them are artists. Well, here's another listener who says, Asian people like to consult astrologists, numerologists, and psychics before going on a journey or starting a business or doing any ventures. It doesn't hurt to obtain such advice. Your chances of being successful by seeking such advice may grow much higher. And another listener says, can you clarify why these experiences are framed as paranormal? From my perspective, sentient beings are profoundly connected to the earth and cosmos. The capacity to be aware of and informed by our interface within this web varies from person to person. However, I do not consider it para, but normal.
Well, this is what the word actually means. It was coined around 1900, and it was an attempt to move away from the language of the supernatural. So what they meant by the paranormal was that it is part of the natural world. It is normal, but it's beyond our present understanding.
It's like metaphysical is beyond the physical.
Para means beyond.
Yeah.
But they insisted that it was part of the normal natural world and that we just didn't have a model yet to understand it. So, it was a move in that direction.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Jeffrey Kripal, chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University, author of On the Edge of the Future, Esalen and the Evolution of American Culture, and his newest, Authors of the Impossible. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll welcome a caller from Pittsburgh. Dean, you're on.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me on. I had an unusual experience when I was a young teenager. I was in a juvenile detention center in Saugus, California, and I'd been in a lot of trouble, and my life was a mess. Anyhow, the hall turned into erupted in a riot, and I was a scrawny white kid, and I was being pretty much beaten up by a dozen or more black kids, and they were chanting this hoorah on the white boys thing, and I had fallen to the ground, and I was being beaten pretty severely, and then all of a sudden something electric or something infused in me, and I was able to jump up and fight them all off, and they were literally scared of me, and it seemed so surreal, like it was a movie or something. And then after this experience, my life completely transformed. I put myself through college. I'm a perfectly normal functioning guy, but I always kind of tried to understand, what that experience was. And from listening to your speaker, it seemed my experience was sort of a paranormal, super experience. And thanks you for the show.
Thank you for that narrative. And so, any response from Jeffrey Kripal?
Well, that's a superhero story, isn't
it?
I mean, you could put that right
into Bruce Willis movie.
Right. Right. You could put that right into any superhero comic. I write a lot about altered states of energy. We're, of course, familiar with altered states of consciousness from the work of Charlie Tard and other psychologists. But often, again, these are altered states of energy. People feel and experience these extraordinary levels of energy. And what you describe there is really...
Could be adrenaline, right?
Well, it's also clearly is. But it reminds me of my own experience in Calcutta. That was not adrenaline, Michael. That went way beyond
something
adrenaline.
Happened.
Yeah.
As Joe Heller said. Let me thank Dean for his call and go to Ryan next. Ryan, you're on.
Hi. I just was calling because I'm not a skeptic of this. I'm more of a skeptic of science, maybe. And I was thinking that on the scale that these phenomena are existing, maybe science is unable to observe, kind of the same way they're unable to solidify their universal theory of matter and on both a micro and macro scale. And I just think it might not be the best gauge for, like, observing things that I find to be that I experience consciously, but I don't know if, and obviously there's no quantifying of these experiences through science, and that's why there's scientists are so skeptical. But anyways, that's just my observation. I'll take my question off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. Any response, Jeff?
Well, I hope that I'm not being heard as anti-science. The book basically says, what can we learn if we look at these experiences with the tools of the humanities and not the sciences? It doesn't mean I'm against science, not at all. It simply means that as humanists who study texts and how to interpret texts, we can also look at people's paranormal experiences as texts, and we can use the tools we have to make sense of those. And I'm simply suggesting that if you do that, if you shift from a scientific method to a humanist method, these things become extraordinarily fruitful. And we can say a great deal about them, actually.
Well, we were just talking the other day about the importance to have convergence between science and humanities. I was in a program for many years that was devoted,
yeah,
an academic program, to that. It's difficult, like
it's you difficult say, yeah, to do. I work with scientists all the time. I have nothing but admiration for science.
Well, here's a listener named Karen, who says, coming from the United States and raised in a very science-oriented home, I very much believe in the scientific method and am often skeptical of claims of paranormal experiences. However, after having lived in villages in both South Africa and Ecuador, I have seen traditional healers do things I cannot explain. In South Africa, many Western doctors and traditional healers will refer patients back and forth depending on what illness is diagnosed, and the police force has an occult unit to deal with crimes based on magic. I was honored to be invited to several traditional healing ceremonies and felt and sensed for myself incredible power emanating from the main healer after he had been trance dancing and prophesying power that I did not feel from him in other day-to-day interactions. I can't explain it, but I know I felt it. Here's another listener who says, my mom worked at Esalen for 20 years, and I have spent much time there. I found your book absolutely brilliant. I also subsequently read Kali's Child, which also was incredibly insightful and helpful to me on my journey. Thank you for your insight and depth. Those are always nice to get.
Thank you.
Here's a reverend who says, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And finally, Buckminster Fuller, Carol writes, became interested in telepathy when his first child began to read his thoughts. She only lived to be four, but it was an experience that opened his mind to the possibility of psychic phenomena. He posited that maybe these things happen due to such high-frequency waves that we do not yet have the equipment to measure or detect. And are any scientists exploring this possibility? Well, certainly there are.
Well, certainly. And, you know, the other thing to say here is that scientists, too, have these experiences. I just finished working on an autobiography of Kerry Mullis, a man who won the Nobel Prize in 1993 for chemistry. And he describes this extraordinary encounter one night in which he lost 5 hours of time. So
we've lost time.
We're out of it, too.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Good to have you here again. Authors of The Impossible, Jeffrey Kripal. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.